So I found, no matter how hard I tried, I could get myself into the state of dhyana, where my mind would go very quiet and thoughts would almost, not quite disappear, but go really quiet and very subtle indeed. But then sooner or later, you know, sometimes half an hour later, sometimes an hour later, sometimes a day or even a week later, the thoughts would come back and I would be back almost where I started before. So I'm not negating the strong effects the experience of dhyana can have on one, but I did start to realize that there's something I'm missing here, because I'm putting in all this energy to create these states, and then no matter how hard I try to hold on to them, or they kind of almost slip out of between my fingers. And then as I started to read more about Buddhism, listen to talks by Sangharakshita and read more books, I started to understand that actually, even though highly desirable that kind of state of mind is, surprisingly, that is not ultimately the aim of the spiritual life, at least not according to Buddhism. One of the way the Buddhism talks of the spiritual path is as a threefold way. Or you could think of it as three stages or three kind of things you have to do side by side. And that's through that threefold way is that of ethics, meditation, wisdom. So the way it's talked about is, yeah, I think of it as almost like a pyramid. So at the base, you've got the big foundation of ethics, a life of, or an ethical life, a kind of a humane life where you're treating yourself and others with kindness and respect. And then on the basis of that, we can go deeper and deeper into these states of meditation, more refined states, more wholesome states, through directly working on the mind through the practice of meditation. So that support is needed for the practice of meditation. But then, much to my surprise, the meditation itself forms a support for something else. Meditation is not, that state is not an end in itself. And that state, that what forms at the top of the pyramid, or what the meditation forms support for, is variously called wisdom or insight or knowledge of things as they really are. So there's a number of different terms in Buddhism which are, I'll stick to the word wisdom, but in a way, what I mean by wisdom is a number of these related terms. For example, prajna is often translated as wisdom, but then there's vipassana, which is generally translated as insight. There's vidya, which is generally translated as knowledge. But these kind of referring to the same kind of thing, which sits on top of the pyramid. So let's call it wisdom. So the question becomes, how does this wisdom arise? Okay, we know what's required as a base, but you know, you can build a foundation. That doesn't mean the building's going to go up automatically. The foundation gives it, it's going to make sure that whatever goes up is going to stay there and going to be solid. And the bigger the foundation, the deeper the foundation, the higher you can build. But the building doesn't go up automatically on the basis of a wisdom, or on the basis of a foundation. So the foundation provides a very important condition, but it's not the only condition. So, you know, we can ask ourselves, in what does give rise to wisdom on the basis of meditation? Any ideas? There's a clue in the topic of my talk. Well, this is what's reflection, yeah. So what gives rise to wisdom on the basis of meditation and ethics is called reflection, or is the practice of reflection. And so that starts to give us a clue of how important this practice of reflection really is. And the process, so the question now, you can ask the question, so how does reflection work? How does reflection give rise to wisdom? And there's various ways to answer that, but one way is through this teaching that the Buddha gave, or what's called the three levels of wisdom. So So he's saying what the Buddha said is like there's a hierarchy of wisdom, or there's levels leading to wisdom. And at the first level is what's called the wisdom through hearing. And in the time of the Buddha, there wasn't very much written down. A lot of the knowledge was passed on through hearing. So when we say hearing, it also means reading. So the knowledge that comes from reading or listening to someone else's writing. So that's the first level of wisdom. And here, particularly in terms of the Buddhist context, what we are concerned about is very much understanding what the Buddha actually said, what Buddhism actually says about the nature of life, about how spiritual life works, about how practices work. So to actually trying to understand what the Dharma, what the Buddhism is actually saying. I mean, we all come to the Buddhism, the Dharma with our own preconceptions, and that's inevitable. But I think what this is pointing out is that's fine, but you gotta make effort to understand what the Buddha is actually saying. We may think we know what he's saying. Some people think all religions are the same, so the Buddha must have acknowledged God, even though he didn't make it explicit. So Buddhism can't be too different from any other theistic religion. And we had this guy day before yesterday in our Bollywood who sang Amazing Grace and made everyone else sing Amazing Grace with him. I'm sure he was well-meaning, but I thought maybe, because he hadn't been coming to the center very long, he thought, well, that's spiritual. So these are Buddhists, they're spiritual, so it must be all the same. So we come with our preconceptions, things we have learned about Buddhism or our ideas of spiritual life. But it is, what this is saying is, well, that's all fine, but we need to actually make an effort to understand what the Buddha really does say. Because the Buddhist approach is actually really radical when we go into it. It's neither theistic nor is it secular. In a way, because those are the two kind of lenses we generally look at things from. Things are either theistic, this is a religion, Islam, Christianity, and so on. Or they're secular things like maybe psychology or mindfulness or any other parts of development. But what is Buddhism? Is it secular or is it theistic? So it becomes quite important to go back to the Buddha and actually find out what he actually said. And there's a number of ways of doing it. I've read quite a few books by people like Sangharakshita, who's the founder of this movement. So, because the scriptures themselves can be quite hard to read, the Buddhist texts can be quite hard to read, but there are some like the Dhammapada or some of the early Pali texts, which are actually quite easy to read, and they're like stories about the life of the Buddha, episodes, incidents of him meeting people, and you get a sense of the flavor of Buddhism from that, and I think that's a good starting point. But that's only a starting point. So that's the first level of wisdom. The second level of wisdom is called the wisdom that comes from thinking, chintamai prajna. And this is kind of reflection proper, you could say, the wisdom that comes from reflecting on what we have heard or read. Excuse me. I remember when I was at university, we were given an assignment on, I can't even remember what topic it was. And the topic of the assignment was a question that we had to answer as an essay of 1,000 words or something. And I remember talking to the lecturer and I said, okay, there's a book about the subject, which is kind of the topic of our that semester. So do you want me to read that book and tell you what this person is saying about this topic? Or do you want me to tell you what I think about the topic? And he said, no, neither. He said, I want you to read the book, think about it, reflect on it, relate it to your experience, and then tell me what you think based on your understanding, the input from the material. So there's kind of an expertise coming in, but there's also a kind of reflection coming in. So I think of this level of wisdom as something like that. So we hear about what the Buddha is saying, what Sangharakshita Buddhist teachers are saying, but then, in a way, to some extent, that's borrowed knowledge. That's a very good start, because that's something that's coming from an enlightened mind, or at least a mind with greater depth and clarity of our own. So it's a very good starting point, and that may be quite inspiring. It may even bring clarity. But Buddhism says it's quite important to actually reflect on it, to think about it, to relate it to our experience. Does this agree with my experience? Does it agree with what I think so far? To kind of kick it around a bit, maybe play the devil's advocate in your mind with it and see if you can find faults with it. So if the Buddha says all things are impermanent, well, are they? I mean, you can try to think whether that's true or not. Maybe you can find something that's permanent, that's not impermanent. Maybe Buddha overlooked something. So I think it's quite important to kind of think about the Buddha's teaching. I remember going through some of this, and I've gone through it with various Buddhist teachings at times, but I particularly remember thinking about karma and the whole that the effects of an action are guided by the intention. So I remember having this conversation with a friend of mine. So does that mean if I accidentally step on someone's hand, that's less karmic than if I intentionally step on someone's hand? And what if I step on someone's hand and I don't even know I've stepped on someone's hand? I played around with it, because if intention was the key, then those things must have different consequences, at least for me and maybe for the world. So that's an example of where you try to play around with the Buddhist teachings. So, and this is really the field of reflection. I mean, there's a third stage of meditation and we'll come to that. And sometimes the word reflection is used in a way that covers all three aspects of wisdom. So through listening, through thinking about things, but also through the third one is through meditating upon a subject. But other writers make a distinction between what they regard as reflection versus what they regard as contemplation. So reflection is something when you reflect and think, ponder upon something that you've read or listened or thought about. And contemplation is something a bit different in meditation. I'll come to that, explain that a little bit. But it's basically, it's a different kind of reflection, if you like. So we'll call that contemplation for now, and we'll call this reflection. You with me? Yeah, okay. So, is it still working? Yeah, it is working. I was thinking, okay, what are the ways in which I reflect? And I wanted to give some kind of pragmatic, practical hints to people about how one could reflect. And, you may be doing some of these anyway, but these are kind of some of the ways I've found useful to reflect over the years. One is giving talks, which I'm doing now. I mean, I haven't done a lot of talks in the past, but I do a few more nowadays. And every time I agree to give a talk, I think, why did I do that? It's like, but I even though I find it, you've got to make time for it, and it's got to put effort, it's actually, I find, a very good way of reflecting, because to explain something to someone, you've got to really understand it yourself, and you've got to put it in your own words to some degree, and you've got to think, whether do I really agree with this, or is this the complete truth, is this the complete picture, and so on. So I find explaining to someone, or at least giving talks, is a very good way of, which enables me to, or forces me sometimes to reflect on an issue. But I think one of my main ones is through what we call study, or particularly studying in groups. So we have here a number of study groups. Like we have three study groups on Thursday nights, which are the men's study group, and I think the women have their study groups. And sometimes we do study in on retreats. We have study sessions. We have study days. So here the study is not so much about, it's not like studying at university or trying to understand mathematics. The word that's used in Buddhism is called Dhammakatha. And what that translates about is it's talking about the Dharma or talking the Dharma. So it's like discussing what you've understood to be a particular Buddhist teaching to be, and hearing up other people's views, maybe even being challenged by them, and you challenging others. And I find that intercourse very useful in clarifying. I mean, it points out holes in my argument, things I may not have thought about, but it also sometimes opens up, this, you know, another perspective on this, or another way of thinking that I myself could not have necessarily stumbled upon. So I find a group study a very good tool for reflecting. Another one that I like is that's actually quite a traditional one, is memorizing. So a lot of importance was placed on memorizing certain teachings, so they're kind of readily available to you, and they're kind of almost etched into your mind. So, you know, I think it's got to be something that you really respond to. So there may be a teaching, you come across a poem or some verses that really speak to you. So just memorize them and bring them to mind every now and then, again and again. So, because if you memorize them, then it's easy to bring them to mind. Also, something to do with the process of memorizing, I think it makes it go deeper. I remember when I was at school, I think the teaching methods have changed, but we had to memorize everything. It's like, that's one extreme, but I think there is some value in the memorizing at least little bits that of teachings or poems or things that appeal to you. You know, there's a particular verse from Dhammapada which I almost repeat at every talk I give. And it's like, and every time I say it, every time I think of it, it goes a little bit deeper. And it's from the Dhammapada. It goes, "The spiritually immature vexes himself. Sons are mine, riches are mine. He himself is not his own. How then sons? How then riches?" And sometimes I just have to say that to myself, and it has an effect. But something about, you know, it's like, it's something I respond to anyway, and then having memorized it, bringing it to mind again and again. And I've probably been doing with this particular verse for a few years now. And I think it just goes a little deeper. Often every now and then I see another kind of glimmer of what it's pointing to that I hadn't seen before. That's another talk in itself. I could give a talk one day on that, just those verses. Another thing I did was, again, to take a Buddhist text or some readings that may appeal to you and just read them again and again. I remember there's a text called Bodhicharyavatara, the sevenfold puja that we do. Everyone familiar with the puja here? So that comes from a text called the Bodhicharyavatara by a Buddhist sage named Shantideva. And over a number of years, I just read sections of that every time, every day, preceding my meditation. I would just read a couple of pages from that, and just kept on doing that. And I found it a very good preparation for my meditation, because it inspired me or linked me into something which was a bit more spiritual from, you know, my daily state, mental state. But also it has a cumulative effect over a period of time. And I probably did it for, again, maybe 3 years or so. And, you know, when I got to the end, I would start again, and then got to the end, start again. And I wasn't trying to finish it or do a certain number of repetitions. I just kept on doing it because it seemed like it was doing something to me. And that's another way, and it's quite an easy way, in a way, to take a few verses and befriend them, let them be part of your life. The Sangharakshita has there's a saying. He says there are no higher teachings, but only deeper understandings. That's kind of pointing to that direction. So another traditional way of reflecting is called is similar to what I just said, but it's called sutra reading. So you read a Buddhist text, but you read it kind of during meditation. So it's almost like a puja. You could think of puja as a kind of a reflection. You're in a meditative state and you're reciting these verses in a calm state. So, I mean, one question you could ask is, what are the topics to reflect on? And traditionally, Buddhism gives a number of topics. For example, a very important one is the three lakshanas, what are called the three signs of conditioned life. And what the Buddha is saying is, look, if you look at anywhere you look in your experience, you'll always find these three things, and that's impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfaction. That's taken as a teaching, and we reflect upon it. So that may appeal to you, and you may take that up, take that up as a reflection. But I think what I found useful is that there has to be an emotional appeal. So if there's a teaching that has a particular emotional appeal, that's the one to take up, because it's probably something that you speaking to you at that time in your life. But it's also if it's something you like, or it speaks to you, you're more likely to stay with it and use that over a period of time. But there can also be, I just wanted to say this, it doesn't need to be limited necessarily to the kind of Buddhist topics. You might find something from literature or art or poetry or Shakespeare or something that really speaks to you, and you may choose to reflect on that, because it may be that it's telling you something about the nature of life. An example I've got is one thing I sometimes reflect on is, and I haven't come across it exactly in that format in any of the Buddhist teachings, but it's like another one of those lakshanas, another one of those signs. Wherever you look, you find it. But strangely, Buddha didn't quite mention it, and that is the sheer unrepeatability of anything. It's always amazed me, even as a child, that everything is so utterly unique, so unrepeatable. You can think about it. This day, this collection of people, this chair, even tomorrow it won't be exactly the same. There's no chair in the world just like that. It's like, isn't it amazing that everything is just utterly, totally and utterly repeatable, both in terms of space but also in terms of time? And that's, in a way, opens me up to the mystery of existence. I look at my son and I think, gosh, there's never been another being like him, and there never will be. Isn't it amazing? And we are all like that. And that seems to be a sign of existence. That's everywhere. So you can find kind of your own ways in like that. Before I go on further to the third level of wisdom, I'll also say a few general words about reflection as to what helps. So I've talked about the ways of reflecting that I find useful, but I thought I'll also talk a little bit about kind of the supporting factors, what supports I need, what things I need to be there for reflection to be effective. And one thing I find that I need is definitely I need a sense of space. And by, that can mean different things to different people. And I don't necessarily mean physical space, but it's more almost like a mental or emotional space. I find if I'm very busy in my work or with just day-to-day practical things, I just I can't reflect, I can't, not very deeply anyway. I seem to need kind of, for example, when I go on a solitary retreat, there's a bit kind of a, my mental space opens up and I can start to reflect on, get a bit more perspective on life and start to reflect on things I may have read. But I think in generally busyness for most people is what keeps us at the surface. And interestingly, you know, there's a Buddhist teacher, I think it comes from Tsongkhapa, but he defines busyness as a form of laziness. So then generally we don't think of busyness as a kind of laziness. And he calls it a laziness because it's like by keeping ourselves busy from things which are in the end inconsequential or of very little consequence, we are stopping ourselves from looking at things that are really of significance. So it's a laziness, an unwillingness to tackle with the deeper questions of life. Because, you know, if we just get ourselves busy with the day-to-day, getting the money in or running the family or whatever it is, in a way, we think we haven't got time for the deeper questions of life. You know, they can wait till we are retired or something, or until we go on holiday. But Buddhism would say that's a kind of laziness. It's like you have to make space for this kind of reflection. And, you know, different people will do it in different ways. I'm not saying that you can't reflect even within a busy life, but it's difficult and it has to be balanced by these times when there is more spaciousness, at least time from time to time. For example, like going on retreat, that's a very good way. And the other thing I find I need is, if I'm immersed in the Dharma in my life, if I'm connected with the Dharma, with Buddhism, I'm reading books, I'm meeting with people in the Sangha, or I'm going to the center, I'm connected with my meditation practice to some degree, I'm doing a study, that context provides one of the necessary conditions for reflection to take place. And then almost when I have space, or when I'm in the right conditions, frame of mind, things bubble up from things I might have been reading, or discussion I might have had in the study group a few evenings before. So that immersing myself in the Dharma allows that to bubble up when the conditions are right. Otherwise, in a way, it becomes harder. It's easier if I'm already immersed in that. Then when I have space, things come up. Thirdly, I find I need a degree of what I would call integration and emotional positivity for reflection to be effective. So if I'm in state of emotional conflict, feeling a lot of very kind of resentful, anxious, scattered, it's very hard to reflect. So I'll read something. It's actually a poem by D.H. Lawrence, which Ratnaguna quotes in this book, Art of Reflection. And the poem is called Thought. Thought, I love thought, but not the jiggling and twisting of already existent ideas. I despise that self-important game. Thought is the welling up of unknown life into consciousness. Thought is the testing of statements on the touchstone of the conscience. Thought is the gazing on the face of life and reading what can be read. Thought is pondering over experience and coming to a conclusion. Thought is not a trick or an exercise or a set of dodges. Thought is man in his wholeness, wholly attending. And I think having that basis of meditation, having a practice of meditation, enables us to have that kind of coherent, wholesome, being wholly attending to what's there. So here we start to see the link why meditation is thought of as a support needed for wisdom. Because without that, it's very hard to have that kind of coherent reflective thinking which leads to anywhere. It'll be more like following hyperlinks to this thing and then there and there and there and there and there. you know, like when you go on the internet and half an hour later you think, what did I start off as? Should we turn the air conditioning on? It's getting a bit, too muggy, I think too hot. Yeah, muggy and hot. So I think with these things, it may start to become clearer that just like meditation, reflection is a skill that can be developed. Yes, some people do have a natural inclination, a natural capacity to reflect, but even you know that can be deepened. And for those who think they don't, it's a skill just like any other which can be developed. You just start from where you are, and you know you start with the way that works for you. That's the other thing about reflection is everyone does it in your own way. You in a way have to find what works for you. I remember one thing that used to work for me really is I couldn't think or reflect sitting or even standing. But if I went for a walk, I could reflect. I found walking, especially aimless walking. If I went with a purpose, like if I'm going to go, I think I'll go to the dairy and get something. It somehow didn't work. I had to just walk. And just walk for the sake of walking through hopefully quiet street or through the bush. And then somehow it opened up the space for reflection to take place. That's one way I found to be effective. And so I'm pretty sure anyone can find out of these various things that I've talked about or some others that you might know, ways that you could reflect or probably already do reflect the fact that you are here. So now I will move on to the last kind of level of wisdom. So this is the wisdom via what's called Bhavana Mai Prajna, or wisdom through meditation or contemplation. So you could say, so how is this different from what we were talking about so far? I think the difference here is that the way we reflect in this way, in meditation is not, we don't discursively think about things. The analogy that's used sometimes is it's like you get into a meditative state of mind, or you do a meditation and then you know just sit, and then you just like a pebble dropping into a water, you just say a few words to yourself, for example, or you just bring to mind a particular teaching, and you just let it have its effect. You don't try to think about it. You don't try to be kind of look at the ramification or the logic of it or anything. You just let it have its effect. And here the memorizing and things like that can be very useful, because I can, like, for example, bring in that verse from the Dhammapada and just let it have its effect. I just think of it as a dropping a stone and just letting the ripples have their effect on me. Sometimes I don't feel anything, but sometimes I feel it's having an effect that's kind of shows up sometimes at other times in my life, but there are also certain Buddhist practices which are very much that kind of meditation, reflection, or contemplation, should we call it. So, for example, there's a practice called the Six Element Practice. Some of you might be familiar with, but there's another one called Buddhanusmriti, or bringing the qualities of mind, qualities of the Buddha to mind. So here we just kind of reflect on the Buddha. Because wisdom, in the end, you know, doesn't exist in abstract. There's only people that are wise. I mean, I don't think any one of us will find wisdom if we went looking for it, going on a tree or even hanging from someone's hair. we'll only find beings, we'll only find people who are wise. So the question becomes, how do wise people behave? Because that's then a way into the state of mind. There's a kind of way. So by reflecting on the qualities of the Buddha, by imagining the Buddha, we kind of connect with that. We connect with wisdom, but through this person. But to do that, we must know enough about the Buddha. We must have some kind of feeling for the Buddha. And therefore, that comes down to that first level of wisdom. You know, we must have read or listened enough about the Buddha. And then, you know, reflected enough upon him for it to work in that way in meditation. So that's why they're called thought of as kind of stages of wisdom. So because for contemplation to be fully effective, in a way, we must have understood it, what it's trying to say, and we must have thought about it, and then by bringing it to mind in a more wholesome state, it has a deeper effect. And the other I guess quality that's different, I think, in this type of wisdom is sometimes this type of wisdom is called insight. And I think that's quite a good word, because it's got this thing about sight that you see. So it's almost like you see something that you have not seen before. It's not that you've had to do some detective work and find out something that was hidden behind there, and you had to figure out there's a clue there. Ah, there it is. That might be the second level of wisdom. But here you just see, you think, why haven't I been seeing this all this time? You might suddenly see impermanence. You think, yes, it's there. It's there all the time. Why don't I see it? Why have I been blind to it? It's almost like ignorance is something active. You know, we think of ignorance as something passive, something we just don't see. But no, I think there's more to it. It's like ignorance is almost an active force that prevents us from seeing what is actually should be obvious. I remember recently on a retreat, it was quite a few days into the retreat, and I had a particularly strong meditation, and I came out and I was just walking in this retreat center, and I just saw this kind of landscape of in front of me of shade and sunlight, and that just spoke to me so deeply. And I didn't think, but I just saw that's all life is. Life is shade and sunshine. There is this pleasure and there's suffering, this pain and this pain and pleasure, and the two, it can't be one-sided. Even no matter how much I may want to just shut out all the painful things in life and just stick with the pleasurable things, it can never be. And on top of that, I blame myself sometimes. When things are not going right, I blame myself, or I blame someone else, or I blame the world for my misery, for my pain. But that's not how life is. So it's not that I thought about it and arrived at a conclusion. I just saw it. And I think it did change my behavior to some degree, and some of that has still kind of stayed with me, I would say. Only time will tell how long it stays, and that depends on the depth of the insight. But I think that's the kind of experience we're talking about when we talk about wisdom through meditation. It's that kind of insight you just see, and it's always there. Life is always there. It was only at that moment that life became that way. But I just don't see it. Emotionally, I see it in a way that just, if I'm not getting pleasure, if I'm in a painful state, I must be doing something wrong, or it must be someone's fault, or it must be the world against me, or something, but anything but seeing what there is. So it's interesting. So, going back to that question of, so what would a person with insight behave like? What would a person with wisdom behave like? And, we can read about the Buddha, and there's also, a lot in the Buddhist literature about how a person with insight would behave, or a person very far advanced on the Buddhist path would behave. And this person is called the Bodhisattva. And there's a lot of sutras, a lot of writings about the conduct of the Bodhisattva, how a Bodhisattva behaves, or the qualities, exhibits. And some of them you already would have come across, and they're very kind of prominent. Say, unselfishness, a person who's, the more mature we become, the more unselfish we become, the more less self-centered we become. Because, for example, we see that is how life is. And we start to see that we are just one center among many, and ultimately, actually, there isn't that division between self and the world isn't quite how we see it either. I think there's a lot of, you would have heard about that aspect of it in a lot of talks. So I want to mention that, but I thought I'll talk about a couple of other ways of looking at a wise person or wisdom that are not generally talked about or not talked about as much. So one way is, it's said a bodhisattva is playful. Now, isn't that strange? You know, because if you think of wisdom as something very intellectual, you think of this like kind of almost like a professor, a very serious professor of Buddhism. But a bodhisattva is playful because he sees what matters and what doesn't. He sees that you know, a lot of things we get so worried about are actually of no consequence, or not much of not much much consequence. So there's a enjoyment to his experience of the world. There's a connection with the deeper mystery of life. You know, he sees that we didn't come all this way. That the human, for example, a human being is, you know, more than just say an office worker, however important that office job might be. We didn't evolve through millions of years to become a really good office worker, or you know, the human being is a kind of mystery and end in himself or herself. So he has that kind of perspective, and therefore it is said his experience and activity in the world is lila, is play. So I think you know, it's good to remember that playfulness has an element of wisdom in it, and spiritual life is not all about being serious. And another way to look at it is, well, a spiritually mature person experiences life and the world in terms of non-utilitarian, and that's kind of linked in with the playfulness. But he sees that in a way, in the end, you could say, you know, there's no purpose to being, or the life is a purpose in itself. And he experiences the world in terms of beauty, in an aesthetic way rather than a utilitarian way. I'll read out something which kind of makes a bit more clear what I'm talking about. This is book by Sangharakshita called Wisdom Beyond Words. So here he's talking about a particular Buddhist sutra called, it's got a very long name, Ratnaguna Samchaya Gatha. But I'll just read a particular paragraph or two. So he says, to sustain life, you have to engage in a certain amount of practical activity. You have to think about things and understand how the world works. But if you are a bodhisattva, all this takes place within an overall context of aesthetic appreciation. We usually think of aesthetic appreciation as a little separate part of life within a much larger area that is utilitarian and practical. But really, it needs to be the other way around. The overall attitude, our overall response to life, should be purely aesthetic. We should not seek to use things, but just enjoy them, appreciate them, feel for them. We can think of ourselves as living within a greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, of which our practical mundane affairs and fulfillment of all our non-neurotic needs and wants occupy just a little corner. The real values are aesthetic, not utilitarian. I'm not talking about some lotus-eating, daydreaming, navel-gazing ideal here. The bodhisattva is the greatest worker of all, constantly responding to the objective needs of the situation. But at the same time, he or she operates within the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So I think, I think it's easy. It's good to bring that these sides of wisdom to mind. That wisdom is not just about an intellectual understanding, but yes, in a way, wisdom goes beyond words, goes beyond thoughts. But the mystery, the strange thing about it is, or the paradox is, that we need, at least to some degree, a certain kind of thinking to get there. So, in a way, thoughts don't have to be. We don't always have to make our minds go blank. Thoughts can be an ally. You know, yes, a lot of the thinking we do is what's in Buddhism is called prapancha. It's like proliferation of thoughts. It's almost the thoughts think us. We don't think thoughts, it's the thoughts thinking us. We just kind of are buffeted by them here and there. So it's not that kind of thinking we're talking about in reflection. Reflection is a more wholesome way of thinking. Because also those kinds of thoughts are underlain with emotions and states of minds that are not wholesome. You know, they're states of minds in conflict lined with resentment and craving. But there's another kind of thinking which is much more kind of directive, but also in an environment of wholesome states of minds, of love, of metta, of a desire for seeking something higher. Yeah, so that kind of thinking is very much to be encouraged, and not just encouraged, but it's as I showed earlier, it's actually vital. It's what, on the basis of meditations, gives rise to wisdom. Okay, I'll stop there.